Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Monty Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the August 30th, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows in the background the island of Greenland. In the middle of a bunch of small buildings is a Trump Tower, Trump Hotel Tower. And in the foreground, on one big block of floating ice, President Trump has just taken a swing with his golf club and hit a golf ball at another floating piece of ice where a polar bear is sitting, and he's holding the golf flag out of the hole. It's got an American flag at the top. And it looks like President Trump's golf ball has missed the other iceberg and gone into the water. The title is Coveting Greenland, Trump's Frustrated Fantasy of Buying the Giant Island from Denmark. And we'll read the article about that when we get to the Talking Points page. But as usual, we'll start with the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's response to recession fears. What happened? President Trump responded with alarm this week to warning signs of a possible recession, first saying he wanted to cut taxes to stimulate the economy, then reversing course and insisting that we don't need it. The White House has been shaken by a raft of troubling economic data, including a brief inversion of the bond yield curve that sent the Dow Jones Industrial Average plummeting by 800 points, an inverted yield curve in which the value of the 10-year Treasury note dips below that of the 2-year notes, indicates investors are worried about the near-term future and has preceded all 7 of the last recessions. Other data show falling levels of capital investment and declining optimism among business owners, with GDP growth slowing to 2.1%. 3 out of 4 economists surveyed by the National Association for Business Economics now expect a recession within the next 2 years. Trump appeared torn over how to respond. At first, he called for a payroll tax cut and capital gains tax cut to bolster the economy, before backing off the idea a day later. Nonetheless, the president again called on Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell to cut interest rates by a full percentage point, blaming him personally for hobbling growth. Privately, Trump told advisors he didn't believe some of the negative economic statistics and publicly accused Democrats and the media of exaggerating the threat in order to harm him politically. "I think the word recession is a word that's inappropriate," Trump said. "We're very far from a recession." What the editorial said: rather than look for scapegoats to blame if the economy slips into recession, Trump should look in the mirror, said the New York Times. Trump's trade war against China and other major American trading partners has created huge uncertainty for businesses and investors around the globe. That uncertainty has corporations sitting on their wallets. The best thing for Trump to do is to stop making things worse by constantly sending contradictory signals. "The president has been badly advised," said the Wall Street Journal. "We've been warning for 2 years that trade wars have economic consequences. But the wizards of protectionism told Mr. Trump not to worry. The main culprit is White House aide Peter Navarro, a tariff-loving China hawk who serves as the president's point man on trade. Fortunately, when markets plummeted last week, Trump postponed plans to impose a new round of tariffs on Chinese goods until mid-December. Trump should go even further and call a worldwide tariff truce. Otherwise, the U.S. could face a Navarro recession." what the columnist said. President Trump's economic message is utterly incoherent, said Josh Barrow in NYMag.com. 1 minute, Trump insists the economy is very strong. The next, he suggests that we need drastic measures to prop it up. So which is it? If the economy is as strong as he says it is, why should the Fed cut interest rates again? If Trump wants a divided Congress to pass more tax cuts, he'll have to explain why his last one isn't boosting growth as promised. If he ends the trade war, he'll have to admit it failed. Trump haters wish there would be a recession, preferably right before the election, said John Crudell in the New York Post. A few, like liberal comedian Bill Maher, have admitted as much. We have survived many recessions, Maher said. We can't survive another Donald Trump term. Rooting for a recession is reckless, especially since Trump is reacting by signaling that he's worried. The quickest way to cause a recession is to kill the confidence of consumers. Trump, like the rest of us, had better hope and pray that we don't have a recession anytime soon, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. The president has left himself few tools to respond if and when disaster strikes. Interest rates are already low, which means the Fed can only do so much to stimulate the economy, and the government can hardly afford more stimulus after Trump spent $2 trillion on a tax cut for corporations that has created a $1 trillion annual budget deficit, leaving little powder left in the keg when we'll actually need it. If there's a recession, it's going to be bad. The title of our controversy of the week is Trump and Netanyahu, Why They Banned Omar and Tlaib. There are few traditions of decorum that President Trump has not trampled on since entering the White House, said the New York Times in an editorial. But last week's foul stunt was new territory, even for him. Democratic Congresswoman Ihan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, both critics of Israel's treatment of Palestinians, were due to visit the occupied West Bank on a trip approved by the Israeli government. Then Trump weighed in via Twitter. It would show great weakness if Israel allowed Representative Omar and Representative Tlaib to visit. They hate Israel and all Jewish people. Within hours, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rescinded the pair's visas, earning swift condemnation from Democrats and some Republican supporters of Israel. Even AIPAC, the conservative pro-Israel lobbying group, said that every member of Congress should be able to visit and experience our Democratic ally, Israel, firsthand. Too late, said Barry Weiss, also in the Times. For the sake of pandering to each leader's far-right base, Netanyahu and Trump have made U.S. support for Israel, long a rare point of national consensus, a partisan wedge in American politics. Israel's interests just suffered long-term damage. Sorry, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com, but Omar and Tlaib aren't mere critics of Israel. They support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS movement, whose goal is rallying the world to destroy the Jewish state economically. Worse, their planned trip was sponsored by Mifta, a radical group that celebrates suicide bombers and which as recently as 2013 was publicizing the ancient blood libel that Jews murder Christian children and use their blood for baking matzos. By what principle of democracy should Israel issue visas to anti-Semitic terror apologists who deny its right to exist and seek its total destruction? That would be like inviting an arsonist to measure your home, said Ari Hoffman in Forward.com, to determine just how much lighter fluid he would need to burn it to the ground. But Trump and Netanyahu just did more to mainstream BDS than Omar and Tlaib's trip ever could, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. Until last week, the movement got little attention in this country. Now young liberal Democrats in particular are learning to associate BDS with the anti-Trump sentiment. Netanyahu has made a crucial error, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. As the U.S. electorate gets younger and more diverse every day, pro-Israel Republicans are disproportionately old, white, evangelical Christians whose influence will shrink when Trump leaves office. Netanyahu has hitched Israel's future to a fading constituency. Netanyahu's desperate, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. Facing indictment on corruption charges, his only hope of avoiding prosecution is to win next month's election and turn Israel into a Jewish banana republic, where it's illegal to prosecute the prime minister. To pull this off, he needs to build a coalition of far-right political groups that openly demonize Muslims. With slumping poll numbers, Trump's desperate too, said Bess Lewis in VanityFair.com. That's why he retweeted a right-wing conspiracy theorist claim this week that Israelis love him like he's the king of Israel and the second coming of God. Even more stupidly, Trump complained that when the majority of Jewish Americans vote for Democrats, it shows either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty. In dredging up the anti-Semitic dual loyalty trope, Trump has proven that he's no better than Omar and Tlaib, and that his support for Israel is entirely transactional. We're up to our good week, bad week piece. Turns out it was a good week for deodorant after a federal energy saving program recommended that people with air conditioning keep their thermostat set at 78 degrees and raise it at night to 82 or higher. It was a good week for keeping your distance with a new survey showing that 45% of Americans admit to having worn the same pair of underwear for two consecutive days or more, with 13% going more than a week. Men are more prone to this behavior. It was a good week for thrill seekers, with the opening in Tokyo of the world's first tapioca theme park. Visitors to Tapioca Land can enjoy a wide range of bubble teas, distinctively filled with tiny spheres of the sweet starch, while reclining in ball pits filled with larger spheres. But it was a bad week for the art of the deal after a miffed President Trump punished Denmark for its disinterest in his offer to take Greenland off its hands by postponing his scheduled September trip to the Scandinavian country. It was a bad week for added protein after a Wisconsin family discovered a live frog inside a box of organic salad greens. I'm thinking, one, how the heck did that get in there, said purchaser Carly Allen, and two, that is absolutely disgusting. Finally, it was a bad week for Latter-day Saints, with an official church clarification that the ban on smoking includes vaping and e-cigarettes, and that the prohibition against drinking coffee extends to iced coffee and, with very few exceptions, anything ending in CCINO. On the briefing page now, America's original sin. The first enslaved people arrived in Virginia 400 years ago this month. How did slavery shape our countries? Who brought in the first slaves? Sometime in late August of 1619, more than a year before the Pilgrims arrived at Plymouth Rock, an English privateer ship named the White Lion, carrying between 20 and 30 Africans in chains, landed at Point Comfort in Virginia. The crew traded the human cargo to colonists from nearby Jamestown in exchange for food. This was the first documented instance of enslaved people setting foot in one of the 13 colonies that became the United States. African slavery, however, was already firmly established in the Western Hemisphere. The Portuguese and Spanish empires began enslaving Africans to work in the Caribbean and Central and South America beginning in the early 1500s to replace enslaved native people who were dying in droves from brutal overwork and imported diseases. The White Lion, essentially a state-sponsored pirate ship, actually plundered the souls it carried from a Portuguese slave ship off the coast of Mexico. The San Juan Bautista, which had set out from present-day Angola. How were these people treated? At first, the Africans were considered indentured servants, not slaves, because many of them had been baptized Christian when they were seized. They were forced to work in the tobacco fields, laboring in the hot sun alongside about 1,000 white indentured servants. Conditions were brutal. Many workers died before their terms of service expired, with disease rampant in the malarial lowlands. White Europeans, however, at least had some choice in the matter. They sold themselves into servitude, usually for a period of 4 to 7 years, in exchange for transportation to the New World and the chance to eventually own land and enjoy the rights of other colonists. A handful of Africans also managed to work their way to freedom, but the ambiguity about their status as property, not contracted servants, was erased over a few decades. These two words, Negro and slave, the Reverend Morgan Goodwin of Virginia wrote in 1680, have by custom grown homogeneous and convertible. What changed? Whites gradually imposed a rigid racial caste system that locked Africans and their descendants into perpetual status as lesser beings with no rights. By the 1650s, many enslaved Africans were held to service for life. In 1662, the colony decreed that children born to enslaved women would inherit their mother's status. Subsequent laws made it legal for colonists to kill enslaved people for not following orders or for resisting arrest. Bacon's Rebellion, a 1676 uprising by white and black workers on the frontier, deeply alarmed the aristocracy and hardened its determination to keep slaves powerless. The colonial elites sought to divide the races to keep the servant class from making common cause, including forbidding interracial marriage. By the early 18th century, Virginia and other American colonies had passed comprehensive slave codes, stripping enslaved blacks of virtually all rights. Masters could do as they pleased with their human property, including beating and whipping them into submission. Rape was commonplace. The genetic makeup of the average black person in the USA today is estimated 16.7% European, in large part because of that brutal legacy. Why did slavery spread? It made slave owners rich. In this pre-industrial era, southern planters growing labor-intensive crops like tobacco, rice, and indigo had an insatiable need for human toil, and slaves were cheaper than indentured servants. Slavery soon spread to all of the American colonies, with enslaved people in New England and the mid-Atlantic colonies working as house servants, laborers, and craftsmen in such industries as glass blowing, ironwork, and weaving. In 1756, enslaved people made up more than a quarter of the population in and around the city of New York. Slaves enriched their owners in a second way by having children, who became the property of the masters. Only about 388,000 people out of the 12.4 million Africans forcibly taken to the New World were sent to North America. Yet by 1860, there were 4.4 million black people living in the U.S., of whom 3.9 million were enslaved. How did slavery affect the U.S.? Slave labor was critical to the economic success of the American colonies and the early republic. Enslaved workers even built the Capitol and the White House in Washington, D.C. Although the institution gradually declined in the North, the invention of the cotton gin cemented it in the South and in the nation's economic life. Throughout the antebellum period, cotton made up more than half of all U.S. exports. Southern cotton fed Northern looms and made Northern investors rich, too. Enslaved workers laid nearly 10,000 miles of railroad tracks, a third of all the nation's total by the time of the Civil War. Slaves were the country's biggest asset class in 1860, valued at more than $3.5 billion in that era's dollars, more than the manufacturing and railroad sectors combined. The idea that the commodification and suffering and forced labor of African Americans is what made the United States powerful and rich is not an idea that people necessarily are happy to hear, wrote historian Edward E. Baptist. Yet, it is the truth. Slavery's imprint on the present. The abolition of slavery did not end white supremacy. Wealthy white Southerners lost most of their wealth right after the Civil War, but regained most of it by reestablishing the region's aristocracy and oppressive racial hierarchy. When federal troops were pulled out of the South in 1877, ending Reconstruction, the newly freed slaves were violently locked out of political and economic life. Many were forced into sharecropping, an exploitative form of pseudo-slavery. Northern politicians embraced legal and de facto segregation as well. African Americans fleeing apartheid regimes in the South were squeezed into economically depressed slums by discriminatory lending laws. A century of legal discrimination crippled black families' ability to get decent educations, find jobs, buy homes, and build wealth. That legacy endures. In 2016, the average black family had a net worth of $17,600 compared with $171,000 for the average white family. We'll read a few of the best columns of the week. The first comes from the U.S. Don't trust the Taliban's promises. The U.S. paid a heavy price for abandoning Iraq, said David Petraeus and Vance Sirchuk, and shouldn't repeat history in Afghanistan. The U.S. is reportedly close to agreeing to a peace deal with the Taliban, in which we'll withdraw most or all of our troops in return for a promise that the Taliban will cooperate against international terrorist organizations and enter direct talks with the elected Afghan government. After 18 years of war, any possibility of settling this conflict is cause for hope. But the Trump administration should not make the same mistake President Obama made in 2011 when he pulled all troops from Iraq. That withdrawal led to Iraq's unraveling and the catastrophic rise of ISIS. If President Trump pulls all U.S. troops from Afghanistan, as he said he wants to do, the Taliban will seek to overthrow the Afghan government and reimpose medieval rule. The country will again become a terrorist sanctuary where Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other groups can train their fighters and plan attacks on the West. Keeping at least a few thousand troops in Afghanistan will carry a cost, but it will pale in comparison with the price the nation will pay if terrorists rebuild a safe haven there. This comes from the United Kingdom. Prepare for agricultural Armageddon. Half of Britain's farms will go out of business if the UK quits the European Union with no deal on October 31st, said Polly Toynbee. That's the conclusion of a grim new report written by Sean Ricard, the former chief economist of the National Farmers Union. Without a trade deal, the high proportion of UK farm produce exported to the EU would immediately be blocked by regulatory barriers and rendered too expensive by the bloc's tariffs on imports from non-members. 27% on chicken, 46% on lamb, 65% on beef. Britain would also revert overnight to World Trade Organizational rules, which means it must let in food from all over the world on the same tariffs and terms, no picking and choosing. The government says it will remove tariffs on imported food to keep prices down, but the resulting import surge would wreck British farming. And what about the famous deal with the U.S. that's supposed to save us? We'll have no leverage in negotiations with Washington if we've already scrapped all our tariffs. Brexit voters were sold on a nostalgic image of Britain's self-sufficient and free, not thrown to the wolves of yet harsher globalization. It's a tragedy that so many farmers voted for this destruction of their own livelihoods. And this one from Russia. Why these protests won't go away. After 20 years in high office, President Vladimir Putin may have cause to be alarmed, said Vladimir Rubinsky. Every weekend since late July, thousands of Moscow residents have taken to the streets to join anti-government rallies. A brutal crackdown on these unauthorized protests, which were sparked by the exclusion of opposition candidates from the next month's city council elections, has only spurred more demonstrations. Muscovites have shown that they're ready to go out and march not only for an election candidate, but also for that candidate's battered voters. More concerning for authorities, the leaders of these protests are getting younger. That's partly because most of the established opposition figures are in prison, but the young protesters don't need them. They have powerful voices from within their own ranks. At the August 10th rally, famous intellectuals shared the stage with pop culture figures like the rapper Face and the sports YouTuber Yuri Dud. Putin is trying to ignore the unrest, letting state TV show him diving in submarines and riding with Crimean biker gangs. But by refusing to comment on the police brutality, he has made himself complicit. Marchers have begun chanting, "Russia will be free." Will he hear that? Moving over to the last word. Our in-depth article, titled this week, "The Infamous Dine and Dash Dater." Paul Gonzalez found women through dating sites, then made them pay for his lobster and steak, said journalist Jeff Mesh in thedailybeast.com. To catch and convict him, a police detective had to get inside his head. One evening in the spring of 2016, Marjorie Moon slipped off her scrubs and watched the emergency room out of her long blonde hair. She stepped into a dress and high heels, transforming herself from a tired trauma nurse into a hot date. The 47-year-old divorcee from Los Angeles was inundated with offers from men on matchmaking websites who often compared her to the Friends actress Lisa Kudrow. For Moon, dating involved racing home from 12-hour shifts while wrangling babysitters. I'd been under a lot of stress, she explained, just single mom stuff and whatnot. I have 5 kids. Scheduling often killed off any romance. Then she matched with a man named Paul on the dating website Plenty of Fish. Smooth-talking Paul shared her love for fine dining and invited her to the Tam O'Shanter, one of L.A.'s oldest eateries. I'm going to go with or without you, he told her, removing any indecision. Soon she was driving across the city, full of hope that Paul, 43, could be the one. He had sent her videos of his 2 adorable young sons and said he was the CEO of the L.A. fitness gym franchise. But as Moon handed her car keys to the valet, she saw her date arrive on foot. She wondered, does he not have a car? Paul's dyed black hair was thick with gel, and he exuded short guy energy. As he held open the restaurant door, his light green eyes sparkled. Look how beautiful she is, said Paul, as the waitress seated the couple. Then loud enough for everyone to hear, he boomed, I don't deserve to be with her. She's so gorgeous. Paul edged his seat closer to hers, then got to work on the menu. Moon said he ordered a salad, chicken fish, and 2 lobster tails on the side. When Paul finished, he summoned 2 more lobster tails. After rounding off the meal with a devilish chocolate souffle, Paul declared that he wanted to date Moon exclusively, then stepped outside to make a phone call. A few minutes in, I had a funny feeling, she said. He never came back. Hot with embarrassment, Moon told the maitre d' she'd been ditched. Soon the waitress was sitting in her date's empty chair, crying. I wish I could take care of your bill, she sobbed. I'm so sorry. But Moon had no tears to cry. She paid the $250 bill and marched out, imagining the cost of the meal in emergency room hours. By the time she reached home, Moon was fuming. When Paul sent her a text message saying, Hi, how are you? She exploded. She called a girlfriend who persuaded her to put the word out. It was late at night when Moon angrily typed a Facebook status update. Here are the pics of the man who ditched me at dinner. Please share on your FB and tell the story so this loser doesn't do this to others. But it was too late. Her post went viral, and her inbox filled with other victims of the same man. His name was not Paul Azzini, as he had told Moon, but Gonzalez. He told women he was an NBC sports editor, a sports agent, and that he worked for the Lakers. Gonzalez was seemingly everywhere. Television stations, a producer from Steve Harvey's radio show, and a Canadian podcast all contacted Moon for interviews. Victims shared other media requests on Facebook Messenger. News anchors soberly issued bulletins warning viewers of the handsome bandit's modus operandi. Gonzalez quickly enticed women into a dinner date, ate like a king, then bolted, deleting his dating profile on the way out. U.S. Weekly and CNN called him the Dine and Dash Dater. Just days after his date with Moon, Gonzalez finished a creme brulee at the Yard House in Long Beach. He held up 2 fingers and told Irene Rodriguez that he had to go number 2 before escaping into the night. I just sat there dumbfounded, she recalled. I was mortified, embarrassed. 2 years later, in the spring of 2018, he was still at it, leaving Tina Martinez to pay for his filet mignon at Smitty's Grill in Pasadena. Even when Gonzalez was arrested for a snip and ditch, he fled a barber's shop with a smock still tied around his neck. Police found no outstanding warrants. His dates were too ashamed to report his dining misdeeds. Had he created the perfect crime? On April 13, 2018, Detective Victor Cass was summoned to his sergeant's office at the Pasadena Police Department. The 49-year-old investigator was handed an anonymous Crime Stoppers report concerning an incident at Buca di Beppo, an Italian chain restaurant in nearby Glendale. An onlooker had noticed a male diner abandon his date and filled out an online report. Cass is slim with tidy black hair and holsters his Glock 9mm beneath sharply cut designer suits. Divorced in 2003, Cass is also a veteran of online dating. When the detective typed Dine and Dash into Google to brush up on the law, he was surprised to find hundreds of news reports about one local man named Paul Gonzalez. He had, like, fans, and they were like, "Hey, he's not doing anything wrong," said Cass. Some websites called Gonzalez scummy and douchebag of the week. This guy was not on any police department's radar, said Cass, yet he was one of the most wanted men in America. 2 weeks after Cass was handed the Crime Stoppers report, Carol Meredith, a model from Santa Clara looking to break into acting, was arriving for a first date with a match from Bumble. Mike told her he was a sports agent, but later said he worked in advertising. He ordered a carne asada and a glass of iced tea, while Meredith ate her chili relleno. Then, when Mike slipped away to use the restroom, he found the restaurant's manager blocking his path. Justin Levas had recognized the man's face from the television. He called up a photo of Gonzalez on his cell phone. "You're the notorious Dine and Dash dater," he asked. "That's you, right?" "Yes," said Gonzalez, stunned. "Well, I'm not going to serve you," said Levas firmly, and chased a flustered Gonzalez out of the restaurant. Levas appeared at Meredith's table and showed her his phone. Her meal was on the house, he said. A few days later, the telephone rang on the desk of Detective Cass. He picked it up. "He struck again," said his lieutenant. "It's on the news. Go look." He hit Mercado. Cass opened an internet browser and typed Dine and Dash for the 100th time. Inside Edition had the scoop. "This man needs to be stopped," Carol Meredith said into the camera. "God knows how many other women he'll attempt to do this to." Mercado was just 9 blocks away. Cass threw on his jacket. The television crew had beaten him to the latest victim, but Cass knew to interview everyone, not just the manager. A server told him, "I also work at Houston's. This guy struck there 2 days ago." Cass knew Houston's had security cameras. He raced there to score video of Gonzalez in action before the restaurant erased it at the end of the week. He watched Gonzalez slipping out the front door mid-meal. "You can see the time frame. Everything was brilliant. Great evidence," Cass said. Back at his office, Cass started to assemble his victims. He saw that the women were from all backgrounds, all races, and ages. Gonzalez didn't seem to have a type. He just wanted 3 courses and zero bill. On May 21st, Cass tracked down Gonzalez's ex-wife, an aspiring Instagram influencer who curates a food and fashion account. Among the avocado crostinis and cucumber margaritas, Cass recognized the 2 children he had seen in photographs Gonzalez had sent victims. Over the phone, she dished up a brief history of her life with Gonzalez. They had fallen in love, married, and settled down, but their relationship soured. She told Cass that Gonzalez had once enjoyed high-paying jobs, but not anymore. She didn't know where he lived. 4 days later, at a luxury apartment building in Pasadena, Cass pressed the buzzer to the home of Gonzalez's mother. "We spoke at length about Paul," he told me. "She is a respected clinical social worker," he discovered, "and her other children are settled and successful. She didn't know where her son was either, and she didn't know about the allegations. She told me Cass questioned her more like a psychologist than a policeman." She said, "One thing I can tell you is that he never forgave me for leaving his dad when he was a kid," recalled Cass. "He's been making women pay ever since," he thought, literally. On the evening of August 25th, 2018, Cass was working overtime in Pasadena's Old Town. He had been tailing Gonzalez for 4 months and started to see Paul-alikes everywhere. Just after 9 o'clock, he noticed a street vendor strolling down the boulevard, hawking Laker T-shirts to tourists. Springing to action, he grabbed the man and threw on the handcuffs, Cass recalled. My partner told me, "Man, Cass is really cracking down these vendors." But then he heard the detective make the radio call. "This is Footbeat 3. We have Paul Gonzalez in custody," the Dine and Dash stater. Cass had a theory that Gonzalez's phone would hold an electronic shrine of evidence. Just as he expected, his suspect's phone was full of dating trophies, photographs of hundreds of women. "I was able to go back to at least 2013, said Cass. During his interrogation, he asked Gonzalez if he was a demented, sick individual, or if he was like sex perverts that get some kind of perversion out of victimizing people. Or was he another type of person, somebody who deep down has a lot of anger because they were abandoned when they were young by their mothers? Initially, Gonzalez was charged with 7 felony counts of extortion, 2 felony counts of attempted extortion, and 1 felony count of grand theft. He ended up pleading no contest to 4 misdemeanors, 3 counts of defrauding an innkeeper by non-payment, and 1 count of petty theft. While it was not the 13-year sentence Cass had hoped for, Gonzalez was sent to jail for 120 days and ordered to pay $240 in restitution to 2 of his victims. There was a party atmosphere outside the courthouse after the judge handed down his sentence. "I believe in karma," laughed Meredith, who had encouraged other victims to speak to the media and the police. "He doesn't have to worry about any meals now. He's going to get 3 square meals a day." Gonzalez agreed to meet me in April this year in a Starbucks in Santa Monica, but later changed his mind about giving a full interview. He claimed he was innocent. Gonzalez insists the whole thing was a conspiracy. "It was the women who catfished him by using outdated photographs," he said. "I got tired of paying for people who are scamming me." According to Gonzalez, his dating days are over. He says he's in a healthy relationship with newborn twins at home. He also boasted of a new high-powered job for Nike and the NFL, which I suspected was another of his fabrications. "The construction of the fantasy seems to be an important part of his process," said Dr. Frank T. McAndrew, a professor of psychology at Knox College. "The only thing that makes sense here is that Gonzalez gets a rush from pulling off each new caper. The planning of it, luring the victim in, and, at least for the moment, being at the center of a desirable woman's attention." McAndrew said he expected Gonzalez to strike again, as the thrill of possibly getting caught is probably part of the fun. "I thought about that when I met Gonzalez for the last time at Starbucks. Early one Sunday morning, he placed a used coffee cup on the counter and asked the server for a free refill. After he bounced off to find a table, a tired-looking manager appeared. 'I've been here since 4:30 this morning, and that man has bought nothing,' she said flatly. 'He's not getting a refill.' Out of embarrassment, I quickly paid for his drink. Not long ago, I spoke to Carol Meredith, who told me that standing up for herself on Inside Edition gave her acting career a boost. She has since appeared on the CBS cop drama SWAT and on General Hospital. She is still looking for love and has returned to online dating. Marjorie Moon, who had sworn off restaurant dates, eventually agreed to meet another handsome stranger from a dating app. She found a babysitter and drove across town. But this time, her date picked up the check," she said, speaking from their honeymoon in Hawaii. A version of this article originally appeared in the DailyBeast.com. Read one of the obituaries this week. The Hollywood Rebel Who Made Easy Rider. Peter Fonda, 1940 to 2019. Peter Fonda wasn't born to be wild, the son of Hollywood royalty with the same penetrating blue eyes and robust jawline as his father, Henry. Peter seemed destined for a career playing clean-cut romantic leads and all-American heroes. Then the 1960s arrived, and he started growing his hair long and smoking pot and dropping acid. Rejecting the warnings of cautious studio executives, Fonda teamed up with Dennis Hopper to co-write and produce 1969's Easy Rider, about a drug-fueled motorcycle odyssey across the Deep South. The movie earned $60 million at the box office and an Oscar nomination for Best Original Screenplay, and kick-started the independent film movement of the 1970s. Fonda's character, nicknamed Captain America for his star-spangled helmet, became an icon of the counterculture generation. It was a market that had never been played to, Fonda said. Nobody had sung their song to them. Born in Manhattan, Fonda was 10 years old when his mother, an emotionally fragile socialite, committed suicide, said the Washington Post. Henry, a cold and distant father, told Peter and his sister Jane that their mom had died of a heart attack. They didn't learn the truth until years later. At age 11, Fonda accidentally shot himself in the stomach with a pistol. He later told the story to John Lennon, inspiring the line, "I know what it's like to be dead," from the Beatles' She Said, She Said. Fonda began his acting career the old-fashioned way, in regional theater, said the New York Times. After a stint at the Omaha Community Playhouse in Nebraska and a string of forgettable films, he found his true persona while starring in edgy, low-budget pictures. In 1967's The Trip, he played a TV commercial director who takes acid for the first time. His father was appalled at his son's hippie antics, and a long estrangement followed, said the Times. Meanwhile, many Hollywood executives viewed Easy Rider's creator as a dangerous upstart, and his acting career stalled. Decades later, he earned an Oscar nomination for Best Actor for 1997's Ule's Gold, playing a Vietnam vet turned beekeeper who finds himself raising his grandchildren. The film led to a late career revival, although Fonda considered himself an outsider to the end. "It was when I came into the counterculture that I came into my stride," he said. "You get in that stride and you can lock yourself in for that long distance run." And we'll just turn right over to the talking points page and start with that article that the cover drawing was about. Greenland, Trump's biggest deal yet? Donald Trump wants to buy Greenland because, of course, he does, said Heather Malik in the Toronto Star. The real estate mogul turned president has been talking about it to his staff for months. If only they had tittered, the world might have been spared this. But instead, Trump's sycophants resorted to their customary, "right as usual, Mr. President," or, "do you know that Nook doesn't have a single decent hotel?" As a result of their cowardice, Trump really is talking publicly about making an unsolicited offer to purchase a glacier-covered expanse of emptiness owned by Denmark and inhabited by just 56,000 hardy Inuits. "We'll talk to them about it," Trump said. "Essentially, it's a large real estate deal." Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen immediately pushed back, insisting, "Greenland is not for sale. Here to America's North, we sincerely hope the Danes stand firm. For surely, after buying Greenland, Trump will turn his eye on Canada." "Don't laugh," said Quinn Hillier in WashingtonExaminer.com. "Trump's idea of buying Greenland isn't entirely wacky. At 836,330 square miles, the world's largest island is rich in rare earth metals, needed by industry, and is of great strategic importance as a bulwark against Russia's expansionist designs on the Arctic. Indeed, it's a brilliant idea, said Matthew Walter in TheWeek.com. The only real upside to global warming is that it's melting glaciers in Greenland that cover vast mineral resources. America might as well profit from the climate catastrophe by mining all of that suddenly accessible ore. So what's a fair price for Greenland? Asked Christopher Ingraham in the Washington Post. Alaska's a good comparison, and the U.S. bought it from Russia for a mere $7.2 million in 1867, or $130 million in today's dollars. In 1946, President Truman considered offering Denmark $100 million in gold, $1.4 billion today for Greenland. But both these figures seem awfully low. Perhaps we should just trust Trump on this one. Back in 2011, when Trump's dream of occupying the White House seemed absurd, he appeared on a Discovery Channel program called Curiosity, What's America Worth? He insisted it was possible to put a dollar value on the entire country. Staring intensely into the camera, our future president said, "Everything has a price." Woodstock, 50 years later, what did it mean? Woodstock was the high point of the 1960s counterculture, said David Colton in USA Today. And for those of us who were there, it remains as real as the moment when the skies opened as Joe Cocker finished, with a little help from my friends. The conditions of the 400,000 of us hippies who swarmed over Max Yasker's 600-acre farm in ticketless anarchy were horrible, with insufficient food, clogged portable toilets, and three torrential downpours that turned the alfalfa field into a clingy, blob-like mud. Miraculously, everyone got along. Huddling for warmth, people slept together in the woods along the groovy way path, whether in relationships or not, and grooved, high or not, to incredible performances by Janis Joplin, The Band, Santana, The Who, Jefferson Airplane, and Sly and the Family Stone. The crowd, the people, us, it turned out, was to be the story. Sharing, dancing, chanting, skinny dipping, surviving. I don't want to rain on anyone's sunlit memories, said Anthony DeCurtis in the New York Daily News. But 50 years on, it's pretty clear that getting back to the garden, as Joni Mitchell wrote in her song Woodstock, was always going to be far more complicated than the era's hippie fantasies implied. It seems we've had nothing but trouble since those magical 4 days. Endless war, division, greed, terrorism, and tumult. Woodstock wasn't a movement, said Gene Seymour in CNN.com. It was a 3-day miracle of peace, love, fun, and great music. Let's recognize Woodstock for what it was. A series of accidents that somehow coalesced into something that may never be duplicated. You should have been there at Woodstock 2019, said Christopher Mogg in the Poughkeepsie Journal. This year's 50th anniversary concert in Bethel, New York, near the site of the first one, was a reunion of old hippies. Only this time, the crowds waited patiently to pass through metal detectors instead of crashing the fence for free. They traded the mud and LSD for orderly rows of lawn chairs and glasses of rosé. They slept at comfy hotels. One guy, Rhode Island prep cook Bruce Mallow, still found the spirit to dance through the crowd with his arms weaving seductively above his head. Then Mallow jokingly yelled, "I can show you my Medicare card." A rebellious generation, it seems, has mellowed out. And we'll read a few of the short notes here, starting with more than 300 people commit suicide each year in American jails, 25% within the first 24 hours of incarceration, and half within 2 weeks. About a third of deaths inside jails are caused by suicide, partly because people are reacting to the shock of incarceration. People awaiting trial or serving short sentences are housed in jails, while convicts are held in prisons. When President Trump held a rally at a Royal Dutch Shell petrochemical plant outside Pittsburgh last week, the union gave workers two choices: attend the rally and get paid time and a half, or take the day off without pay. No yelling, shouting, protesting, or anything viewed as resistance will be tolerated at the event, one contractor told its workers at the site in a memo. President Barack Obama and Joe Biden spoke at least half a dozen times before the former vice president launched his own presidential campaign. You don't have to do this, Joe. You really don't, Obama told Biden. Nevertheless, Obama has continued to informally advise Biden's campaign. The parents of Dayton, Ohio mass shooter Connor Betts apologized for publishing online an insensitive obituary of their son that made no mention of the massacre that left 9 dead, but described him as a funny, articulate, and intelligent man with striking blue eyes and a kind smile. The obituary has since been removed. And we'll finish up with a quote from advice columnist Abigail Van Buren, quoted in goodhousekeeping.com. She says, if you want children to keep their feet on the ground, put some responsibility on their shoulders. And that's it for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The podcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 919-832-5138.